You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
For the first time taking their eyes off Jilin, the boys gaped at what appeared to be a raven speaking gibberish. "Here," said Jilin, touching the elder's foot with his hand. With his old comrade nearby, the lad felt better.
"We must go in," said Ruggum firmly.
Turning to the boys, Jilin asked them to open the enormous door. Christopher was fascinated, his eyes darting from the raven to the tiny being during their unintelligible conversation. Going to the screen door, he pulled it open. Jilin stepped over the doorstep into the man-made building and was followed by a strutting Alsanam, the practical but reluctant Ruggum aboard. The Kirins found themselves within a cavernous, labyrinthine interior, enormous chambers jutting off both sides of the corridor. Jilin looked back at the boys in the doorway. "Where is the raven?"
"Grandpa!" called Christopher.
The old man appeared in a doorway at the end of the hall, holding Loana carefully.
"In the shop room," he said, and again moved out of sight.
The Kirins started down the hallway, Jilin trotting and Ruggum on his raven. The boys followed, the screen door slamming behind them and alarming the Kirins momentarily. Arriving at the end of the hall, the Kirins turned into the room and looked up to see the old man doing something at the far end of a high wooden bench, but they couldn't see Loana. Certain he could scale the structure, Jilin strode to the nearest leg and started up. When Kirins climb sheer surfaces, they employ their feet almost exclusively, their upper limbs being used for balance and control. Finding toeholds and minute irregularities, he ascended effortlessly, the boys ogling his every movement from the doorway. The overseer dismounted. Leaving Alsanam at the foot, he too gripped the wooden leg and climbed with the same agility as his young companion. Reaching the top, Jilin pulled himself over the edge and onto the flat upper surface. Ruggum followed shortly, and Jilin touched him on the shoulder. They stood near the edge, watching the old man as he began washing the raven's wing in a basin of soapy water.
"Cleansing is correct," whispered Ruggum to Jilin. "Though uncomfortable to Loana, the wounds must be thoroughly bathed. I can only hope the liquid has the proper ingredients. Then the bones must be set and splinted. I must be involved in that." "At home," thought the overseer, "a team in the gathering place, the entire clan, if necessary, would clean the wounds, set the bones, and dress and immobilize the wing. The island would be observed and nurtured for weeks and gradually allowed activity. Here it would be different."
"I must speak with it," whispered Ruggum, nodding toward the man.
Because he was visible and had the calamar, Jilin would be the intermediary between the old Kirin and the old human. Jilin took a deep breath and addressed the man. "My companion is an experienced clan overseer." The startled John Versteeg looked up from his work and glared at Jilin. The young Kirin took an anxious step backward, then went on. "He's accomplished in treating injured birds and animals, both initially and as they recover." The old man was shaken by today's events, but gently washing the wounds in the clean basin made him concentrate, which calmed his nerves. He hadn't noticed the Kirin at the other end of the table. To see it disturbed him all over again, and what it said was puzzling. He cleared his throat, licked his dry lips, and replied,
"Well, then, I can probably use his help. Where might he be?"
Knowing Ruggum was invisible, Jilin first introduced himself, then the overseer. "My name is Jilin," he said, then gestured toward his companion. "And this is our clan's admired elder, Ruggum Chamter." The bewildered gentleman and two enraptured boys stared at the nothingness their tiny guest was indicating. Chapter 34. Striding across the cave's floor, Hutt and Lindor were in animated conversation, Hutt gazing about, amazed at the immensity and intricacy of the space, paying no attention to amused passers-by who stared at his green Farinan pajamas. "What will he give me?" asked Lindor. "Ooh," said Hutt, glancing at his small companion, intrigued by the mellow nature of his voice. "You're a magician. He said it would be something from his bag. I found the silver box and the vial."
"Oh, I was asleep when that happened. I have no idea. But if he promised something, it'll be worth waiting for."
He paused.
"Where did you find them? They were mine, at least on the trip to the Barwood Grove."
"In the stream," Lindor began trotting toward the water, Hutt following.
"They were glittering at the bottom. I dove down to get them, right there."
Stopping, he pointed. Hutt gazed out into the moving water, searching the rocky bottom, imagining the silver objects glimmering there. Lindor ambled to a pile of stones near the water, then reached down and brought out a knife from behind them, its blade gleaming.
"It was in the water, too, near the other things. It's yours, isn't it?"
"My pruning knife," said Hutt, surprised to see it. He walked over and Lindor handed it to him.
"I killed 2 Granums with it," said Hutt. "Know what they are?"
Lindor's mouth gaped in amazement, and he nodded.
"Thanks for finding it," said Hutt. Glancing down at his pajamas, he shrugged. "No belt, no satchel."
He held the knife out.
"Keep it until I get new clothes."
Staring at it in awe, the boy took it and turned it over in his hands, then slid it proudly under his belt. Arriving on the bank was another Shillitoe who stopped a short distance away, observed the 2 lads, then strolled over to them. He had reddish-brown hair and eyebrows, and his gentle, dark green eyes sparkled like the ancient queen's. He smiled at Hutt.
"I like your outfit."
"It'll have to do till I get a new one," said Hutt, eyeing him.
"I've never seen hair like yours before."
"You don't remember me," said the stranger, "but we rode together on my Eilon from the hemlock tree to this cave. I'm Runagar."
"Did you save me?"
"Not exactly. Near the Barwood Grove, the scent of barwood sap was in the air. Searching the grove, Issar and I found you."
As with Lindor, Hutt was struck by his voice. It had a subtle elegance and a timbre pleasing to his ear.
"I was told," said Hutt, "I was some distance from the tree when I was found. The last thing I remember was being overcome near the trunk. I could barely move. My chest was so heavy I had a hard time breathing. Then everything was a blur."
He stopped, suddenly realizing what a deadly situation he had been in.
"You were there. Did it look like my raven saved me?"
"From footprints and tracks, we concluded that she carried you away, doubtless in her beak." Hutt's voice was subdued.
"I've never heard of anything like that."
"Nor had we. She must have sensed the danger to you, perhaps to herself as well, because barwood liquor is as hazardous for animals and birds as it is for us."
Hutt thought of Lisan.
"What a brave, faithful bird. I haven't had her long, and I'm not even her true master. Yet apparently, while risking her life, she saved mine."
"Where are the ravens?"
Runagar pointed to one of the shafts radiating outward from the base of the cave.
Hutt looked, but something else caught his eye, the sleek animals resting and sauntering about in several other passageways. He was intrigued by their size, beauty, and gentle but powerful movements.
"Are those your Eilon?"
"Indeed, we Shillitoes have used them for centuries."
"To think I rode on such a creature and didn't even know it."
"And your girl, still in the Farinan, rode with Issar on his. Where do you and your party come from?"
Hutt told him, and they briefly discussed their very different lifestyles. Hutt's clan living in a tree, the Shillitoes in this cave. Hutt eyed the sheer wall and its surface honeycombed with doorways, balconies, and stairs.
How many are in your tribe?
I know, said Lindor, left out of the conversation for a time. There are 988.
That's a lot, said Hutt.
More than 10 times the number in my clan at home. How do you get to know anyone?
We know everyone, said Renegar. We live in one place and see each other all the time. 3 or 4 times that number once lived here. Some sort of plague or disease struck, and the population has never been as large. But I envy you for living in a tree. I've wanted to since I was small. Then I could fly.
You've never flown, said Hutt.
Renegar shook his head slowly. We're taught that flying is perilous and birds can't be trusted.
Issar reminded me of that when we saw your girl on the ground having fallen off her bird. No one in this tribe flies, but I'm not afraid to. I've always wished I had a bird eidolon and dreamed of flying.
The Shilarans, who live a short distance away, have bird eidolon. We, of course, have none. Haven't for centuries, and the elders intend to keep it that way. He glanced down, then back at Hutt with an earnest look.
Even though we just met, I'd like to tell you something. Inside of me, something is growing. A need to know things, do things, and one of them, a very strong one now that you and your birds are here, is flying. What's it like to fly? He paused. Is there any chance of me riding on one of your ravens?
Hutt's jaw dropped. Even Renegar's asking him made him realize that this Shillito knew nothing about Bird Eidolon.
Hutt shook his head.
I don't think it would be a good idea.
I might never get the chance again, said Renegar.
Hutt recalled his own dreams of flying before they became a reality and knew how Renegar was feeling.
He rescued me, thought Hutt. I wouldn't even be here without him. Why not do something in return? It's the least I can do.
But he doesn't know a thing about flying.
We should talk to Spekeren first, said Hutt.
He might say no, said Renegar, and I'd never get to fly.
Maybe that was meant to be, thought Hutt. Renegar's argument went on, Hutt making note of his voice, stirring and melodious.
You're off the ground, said Hutt, sometimes very high, which can be frightening.
I'm not afraid of heights, said Renegar.
You'd have to control the eidolon in the air, said Hutt.
Will you show me how? Asked Renegar.
Hutt thought for a moment.
I think I could do that.
Of course they're not birds, said Renegar, but I'm an expert at controlling our foxes.
We could go for a short, easy ride, thought Hutt. How bad could that be?
Thus, though he couldn't tell whether the argument, the voice, or both were influencing him, he made a decision.
I'll take you. I think we'll be fine.
Great, said Renegar.
Me too? Asked Lindor. Hutt paused, because the boy had salvaged his pruning knife.
I'm afraid you're too young, he said.
Looking again for the ravens, Hutt saw them in their tunnel and pointed.
Would you like to visit them?
Thought you'd never ask, said Renegar, and the three of them started off. Entering the corridor, they found Lisam, and Hutt placed a hand on her feathery shoulder. He spoke Curlay's phrases, praising and thanking her for her courage in rescuing him, the two Shillitoes looking on with profound interest. Lisam had seen her young master collapse at the foot of the barwood tree. She later observed his limp body being transported on a foreign animal. The last time she saw him, he was lying on a stretcher and appeared lifeless. Like all eidolon, she was outwardly unemotional, seemingly unmoved by events around her. But her master had reappeared, resurrected, and the great bird was so relieved that from her throat came a sound Hutt had never heard and didn't know she could make, a husky purring of satisfaction. Stroking her neck, he tried to reassure her that he wouldn't leave her alone again. The three Kirans departed the ravens, and Lindor ran off to show Hutt's knife to his friends. Renegar and Hutt stood by the stone bridge, discussing the matter of Renegar flying, the Shillito increasingly excited about it. They decided they would do it the following morning, but the plan's details were not developed. Then Runagar took Hutt on an exploration of the cave and its surroundings. In the main hall, they climbed up and down routes cut into the stone. Runagar also introduced him to something the other travelers knew nothing about, an elaborate labyrinth of passageways behind the circular wall and under the cave's floor, all completely dark. The two companions weren't there long, but long enough for Hutt to realize he could have become lost had it not been for his experienced guide. Finally, Runagar took him to his family's home in one of the cave's upper corridors, introducing him to his mother, father, and younger sister.
"This is not my usual attire," said Hutt, for the first time self-conscious about his pajamas, and explaining what happened to his clothing.
But at Runagar's request, their plans for the following morning weren't mentioned. The tribe's prejudice against birds was strongly endorsed by his own family. According to Runagar, it was late in the evening when he escorted Hutt back to the guest chambers.
"How would you know that?" asked Hutt, glancing about the cave. "Those torches are as bright as before. We have no idea whether it's dark outside. How do you know what time it is?"
"We have instruments for that," said Runagar. "If you want, I'll show you one tomorrow. They're very important. When we go out on a mission, such as the one during which we found you, we don't want it to be at an inopportune time, like the middle of the night. And by the way," he chuckled, "you were a sorry sight when we came across you, and very lucky we happened by." Shaking his head, Hutt took a deep breath.
"I know. I hope our excursion tomorrow will in some measure make up for what you did."
They arrived at the corridor to the guest chambers, an attendant showing them to Hutt's room.
"Come by early in the morning," said Hutt as Runagar left.
The Shillito was so excited he slept little that night. Arising early, he left home without breakfast. Hutt was also awake early, but not for the same reason. He was in a quandary about his decision to take Runagar flying. "Of course, Lisam would go with me," he thought, "but how would I persuade another Ilan to go with Runagar? And which one? Should I take him at all? Spekran and Deliani would never approve of my untrained friend aboard one of our ravens." Having thought about it much of the night, Hutt had grave doubts about it himself. And Deliani had mentioned that, while the birds would be happy to be outdoors, they would not enjoy traversing a tunnel to get there. But she didn't say why.
"I should try to discourage him," thought Hutt. "But he rescued me. I agreed to it, and he's looking forward to it immensely. What did I tell Lindor about Spekeren's fulfilling a promise? He would do so without question."
When Runagar entered the room, Hutt brought up what Deliani said about departing through a tunnel.
"Oh, that's no problem," said the eager red-haired Shillito. "Large ventilation shafts are in the ceiling. We could fly up and use one."
Hutt was amazed, again realizing what a novice he had on his hands. With no training, Runagar was proposing to pilot a strange Ilan off the floor and through a hole in the dome-shaped ceiling. It would be doomed from the start.
"An expert might not be able to do that," said Hutt. "And I can't teach you to fly inside the cave. Spekeren and Deliani would have a fit. Are there other exits?"
"Just tunnels like the one we used to enter.
Apparently the ravens weren't fond of them.
But they made it. We saw them all yesterday. They didn't look any worse for the wear, and I'm sure they'd rather be outside than in." Runagar wouldn't give up. He was an enthusiastic and convincing hopeful, all in his melodious, persuasive voice. Again, Hutt couldn't tell whether it was the arguments or the voice, but he finally caved in. The two made their way down to the floor. It was so early, no one else was about.
"I'm thankful for that," thought Hutt, getting tired of his Farinan pajamas, hoping his new suit would be ready soon.
They entered the tunnel housing the ravens. Lisan was immediately alert, Hutt greeting her warmly. Then he glanced at the other birds, trying to decide which to approach for Runagar. Afraid of repercussions if they took Speckrins or Deliani's, he chose Tally's Farallon. Going to the bird, Hutt stroked him gently.
Aran, he said,
a word he had learned when very young and used frequently with Stala, his squirrel. He also spoke phrases he learned from Lugor on Rogustin. Talking softly and caressing the raven's neck, he motioned for Runagar to come closer. The last time Farallon saw Tally, she was alarmingly limp and unresponsive. He was deeply concerned about her, and in this state perhaps more easily persuaded than usual. Normally he would have hesitated to take on a strange master, but didn't, as Hutt introduced the excited Runagar. Hutt departed the tunnel with Lisam, and Farallon took little coaxing to follow Runagar. The Kirins and Ilon proceeded across the stone bridge to the arched entrance the birds had passed through the day before. Recognizing the archway and the dark space within it, the ravens shied away. Through pleas and commands, and by praising and stroking the hesitant creatures, the Kirins persuaded them to follow. Though reluctant, Lisam entered after her young master, and Farallon after Runagar. Deliani awoke, refreshed after a deep slumber. To her surprise and pleasure, the attendants had cleaned and folded one of her gowns and delivered it back to her room. While traveling, she washed her clothing in ponds and streams whenever possible. But for the first time since leaving home, it was immaculate, and she delighted in putting it on. Finding food on a silver platter, she consumed a delicious and leisurely breakfast, having no idea what time of day it was. She left her room and strolled down the hallway, noticing that no attendants were present. Stepping onto the veranda overlooking the cave, she stretched and gazed about. Relishing the view of the splendid interior, her eyes fell upon a raven at the arched entrance. She recognized him as Farallon and was surprised to see him there. What could he be doing away from his place of rest? She called his name, but he didn't seem to hear. Then he stepped into the dark opening and disappeared.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kirin's, visit www.kirinbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.